Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Richard Martin. It's the wake-up call coming to you live from Singapore on this 19th day of March 2012. Well, have any of you heard about the new microwave active denial systems? They're the latest heat ray guns, and they were originally designed for military application, but the Pentagon denies they've ever been used in the Middle East theater of war. Apparently, they were deployed to Afghanistan, but military commanders decided against their use on civilians because the weapon would reportedly make the war for hearts and minds more difficult to win. Turns out that the Los Angeles Police Department then took possession of some of the non-lethal heat ray guns, saying they would be used in their prison systems to quell inmate disturbances, but later changed their reason for acquiring the weapons. They would be used for helping to combat crowds. What's most alarming, Alexander Higgins points out, is that recent anti-terrorism and anti-assembly laws, coupled with deployment of these weapons by local law enforcement agencies, suggests a new and alarming trend in the United States. In America, the war is not about winning hearts and minds. It's about crushing dissent and free expression and destroying any ability for the people to peaceably assemble or to petition government for a redress of grievances in a free and open forum. So we know that the Pentagon plans to deploy 20,000 troops within the U.S. to deal with civil unrest. The new NDAA bill authorizes the military to be deployed to attack any nation in the world without congressional approval, including inside the United States. The bill allows the military to treat American citizens, such as Occupy Wall Street protesters, as terrorists by labeling them as threats to national security and to detain them indefinitely in military prisons or even secretly target them for assassination. Of course, the threat of Occupy protesters being labeled as terrorists were realized when leaked documents revealed the police classified the Occupy Wall Street as a terrorist group alongside Al-Qaeda. Then, just a few days ago, we received word of the military's first plans to deal with protests during events of civil unrest, a microwave heat gun crowd control cannon. That article described the technology in writing and showed a heat gun cannon in action. Now we have our first corporate media reports on the Army's new pain ray gun with more details and the military plans for using the weapon. And by the way, future protests organized in the streets of major cities may very well be met with a jamming of all internet communications in a target area to restrict real-time flow of images and video across the world. Direct targeting of protesters by non-lethal weapons like the microwave heat ray guns and LRAD acoustic systems, and the unwarranted arrest and detainment of those in areas deemed of interest to national security. Again, I urge you all, ladies and gentlemen, do not for one moment be tempted to believe that you can oppose this in any manner, shape, or form. Your only reasonable protest is going to be with your feet, a one-way ticket to wherever. Well, last week, President Obama signed into law the Federal Restricted Buildings and Grounds Improvement Act of 2011. This law permits Secret Service agents to designate any place they wish as a place where free speech, association, and petition of the government are prohibited. And it permits the Secret Service to make these determinations based on the content of speech. In other words, federal agents whose work is to protect public officials and their friends may prohibit the speech and the gatherings of people who disagree with those officials, or permit the speech and the gatherings of those who would praise them, even though the First Amendment condemns content-based speech discrimination by the government. The new law also provides that anyone who gathers in what they call a restricted area may be prosecuted. And because the statute does not require the government to prove intent, a person accidentally in a restricted area can be charged and prosecuted as well. This abominable legislation enjoyed overwhelming support from both political parties in Congress. It passed the Senate by unanimous consent, and only three members of the House voted against it, and the President signed it in secret. Need I say more? All right. Well, today in the Singapore Straits Times, I came across a full page consisting of three articles, and they were articles about war with and by the U.S. One of them was an article about cultural reasons that China won't go to war with US, with the U.S. Another one was making peace between two world models, in other words, the U.S. and China. And the one I was most interested in was one entitled "Declining America is the Worry, Not Its Rising Partner." Well, this is an article by someone called Terry Gnardin, who is currently the head of the Department of Political Science at the National University of Singapore. He is an American, and he does have quite a distinguished resume in various different universities, including, I believe, Stanford and Yale. I'm going to read you a couple of excerpts from this because it absolutely reflects my complete and utter conviction as to what is happening in the United States right now vis-a-vis China. And one of the passages goes like this. He says, "A hollowed-out middle class creates a nation that feels overtaken by events, especially among those who have lost their former status. Resentment can become the motor of hatred, xenophobia, and authoritarianism. These poisonous elements have found their home in an increasingly unhinged and destructive Republican Party, which, while serving the rich, exploits the anger of a vast, ignorant, and angry swath of the country. The result is the manipulated idiocracy on full display in the Republican presidential primary contest." And then another excerpt. "There are situations in which the motives for war identified by Thomas Hobbes, scarcity, fear, and vanity, can be triggered and a country becomes irrational and irresponsible. mischief makers, which in the U.S. include right-wing funded hate radio, can stir up trouble. A divided political scene can generate extreme parties and leaders. It is easy to mobilize populations against scapegoats, including foreign enemies, quote-unquote, when times are bad. Another one, the so-called power transition theory, that wars occur when one power overtakes another, does not leave room for intelligent choice, either in planning for challenges or meeting them. And then finally, there is reason to worry about the American half of the China-U.S. partnership. For this reason, we should be paying more attention to how the U.S. can prudently manage a power equation that has been shifting in China's favor. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I don't think much of that leaves room for interpretation. It's pretty obvious that this man is concerned by exactly the kind of things that gave us problems in the early 20th century when Britain basically declared war on Germany for whatever reason, and then again, of course, in 1939, Britain being the United States of the moment, supremely powerful with a challenger in the form of Germany, in the same way that the United States is presented with China. And it is very worrying to see the various different things which are coming up, and I'm reading them especially in blogs these days, this kind of vitriolic hatred that seems to be springing up with China that I don't really understand, but nevertheless have to come to terms with. Anyway, so there you have it. There's going to be a lot more to talk about in the future months, I fear, but, well, you know my view about your own personal response to these things, so I shall not revisit that here. Instead, I will give you my information quickly. This is the wake-up call and the toll-free number to call in with your questions and your comments and observations is 888-874-4888. That's our toll-free number. Please use it. Please call and let me hear what you have to say. So much more fun to talk about it live than to have to give you a rather cold and depressing answer from an email. But if you should wish to email me, that is perfectly okay. You may do that too. And the email address is rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin. GFAWD stands for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design. That's rm@gfawd.com. And my private number, direct line, if you would like to call me, just dial the number in Sarasota, Florida, and your call will wing its way across the waves to Singapore. And the number to dial is 941-441-1682. That is a call to Sarasota, Florida, where your financial responsibility ends. And again, the area code is 941. The number is 441-1682. Well, ladies and gentlemen, next Sunday will be the 7th in a line of meetings known as the Richard Martin Meetup Group, and they meet once a month at the end of the month in the George Street Ale House in New Brunswick, New Jersey, which is kind of equidistant between Washington and New York City. Those of you in New Jersey who would like to get together to talk about the reactions to what's going on today in America and elsewhere, and to learn about ways in which to extricate yourself from the environment and wing your way to other climes, should visit the Richard Martin meetup group in the George Street Ale House in New Brunswick, New Jersey, right close to the railroad station in New Brunswick. And the address of the George Street Ale House is 378 George Street. That will be on Sunday, the 25th of March at 2 p.m. Sunday, the 25th at 2 p.m., please make it a date. And if you would like to ask Susan, who is our moderator, questions about this, she will have people, I believe she's going to have people to come and talk to the group next, or at least somebody's coming to talk to the group next Sunday. Please do feel free, call her, and her number in Washington, where she lives, is area code 202-246-5131. That's Susan Alexander, our moderator, who would like to hear from you, especially if you would like to go to the event. She can put your name down. She needs to, of course, she needs to organize the room, the meeting venue, and so she needs some numbers. So please go. Please do visit the group and offer your own contributions and listen carefully to what is being said and advised at that point. Her number, once again, Susan Alexander, is to be found at 202-246-5131. Okay, so that's the Richard Martin meetup group, Sunday, the 25th of March at 2 p.m. in New Brunswick, New Jersey. All right, well, Michael Fleischer, the president of Bogan Communications, wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal recently entitled, "Why I'm Not Hiring." And this is the following is how Paul Holra of Family Security Matters summarized the nightmarish taxes that are imposed on his company when Fleischer hires a new worker. And according to Fleischer, Sally grosses $59,000 a year, which shrinks to less than $44,000 after taxes and other payroll deductions. The $15,311 deduction from Sally's gross pay is comprised of New Jersey state income tax, $1,893, Social Security taxes, $3,661, state unemployment insurance, $126, disability insurance, $149, Medicare insurance, $856, federal withholding tax, $6,250, and her share of medical and dental insurance, which comes to $2,376. So roughly 25.9% of Sally's income is siphoned off by Washington and Trenton before she receives her paychecks. But then there are the additional costs of employing Sally. In addition to her gross salary, her employer must pay the lion's share of her health care insurance premiums, namely $9,561. Life and other insurance premiums, $153. Federal unemployment insurance, $56. Disability insurance, $149. Workers' comp insurance, $300. New Jersey State Unemployment Insurance, $505. Medicare Insurance, $856. And the employer's share of Social Security taxes, $3,661. So this means that over and above her gross salary, Bogan Communications must pay an additional $15,241 in benefits and state and federal taxes, bringing the total cost of employing Sally to approximately $74,241 per year. Sally gets to keep $43,689, or just 58.8% of that total. It's not hard to understand why so many businesses are hesitant to hire new workers, is it? The big corporations can handle all of the paperwork and regulations that come with hiring a new worker fairly well. But for small businesses, hiring a new worker can be a massive undertaking. That new worker is going to have to almost be a miracle worker in order to justify all of the hassle and expense. Well, the other day I listed as my quote of the day to my email subscribers a quote from Justice Martin V. Mahoney in First National Bank of Montgomery versus Jerome Daly. He said, "Only God can create value out of nothing." So indeed, what is fraud except creating value from nothing and passing it off as something? Frauds interlink and grow upon each other. The United States debt-based money system saves as the fraud foundation. In its debt-based money system, debt must grow in order to create money. Therefore, there is no way to pay off aggregate debt with available money. More money must be lent into the system to make the payments for old debts. This causes overall debt to expand as new money for actual people versus banks always arrives at interest and compounds exponentially. This process is called financialization. Financialization is the process of making money from nothing in which debt, i.e. poverty or lack, is paradoxically considered an asset, i.e. wealth or gain. In current financialized economies, wealth expansion comes from the parasitic taxation of productivity in the form of interest on fiat lending. This interest over time consumes a greater and greater share of resources, assets, labor, and livelihood until nothing is left. Now, ladies and gentlemen, remember, every time the Fed issues new money, that money comes into the system as debt. Now, when money comes into the system of debt, interest has to be paid back on that debt along with the debt itself. Trouble is, the Fed forgot to issue the interest with which to pay back the debt. And if it had issued the interest to pay back the debt, that interest itself would have come in as debt. So you can see, in the end, the concept of the Fed issuing money out of thin air has to lead to disaster because there is never going to be enough money to pay the interest on the debt that the Fed has just issued. You see, it's only in a debt-based money system that debt could be curiously cast as an asset. We've made extend and pretend a quaint phrase for a burgeoning market for financial lying and profiteering aimed towards preventing the collapse of a debt or lack-based system that was already doomed by its initial design to collapse. So the primer will deal with major components and basic evolution of fake wealth creation, accelerating debt expansion, hollowing out of the economy, and inevitable financial explosion. The Federal Reserve is a private, non-transparent entity formed in 1913, representing and serving private, profit-driven banks that create money from nothing, in other words, fiat money, and to which the U.S. government has delegated and effectively ceded its constitutional power to coin that money. The Fed essentially lends the United States is very own sovereign public money to Americans, making them pay interest on their own money, paying for things like government debt with more debt, thus expanding the debt. By contrast, the Fed currently gives away money to its constituent private banks at 0% interest, allowing those banks to buy U.S. Treasury bonds, which yield a 2 to 3% interest markup, to be paid by none other than, yes, you, ladies and gentlemen, the taxpayers, which, of course, adds to citizen debt. Then we have fractional reserve banking, which is the private fiat fabrication of exchangeable public money as a bookkeeping entry through multiplication of public fiat held in private bank reserves. Holding $100,000 of depositors' money may allow me as a bank to lend out $1 million, but by what authority? None, really. It's just my say-so and my action. In the court case I mentioned just now, Justice Mahoney ruled against a bank acting in conjunction with the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis in its efforts to foreclose upon and buy a U.S. citizen's house by simply creating the entire $14,000 foreclosure purchase in money or credit upon its own books by bookkeeping entry. Further, Mr. Morgan, the plaintiff or bank representative, admitted that no United States law or statute existed which gave him the right to do this. After money is created out of thin air, other market mechanisms have been propagated to magnify, funnel, and package value for nothing further still, creating financial vehicles that add more numbers without adding more value. And, of course, finally, you have leverage, which is the practice of arbitrarily multiplying one's alleged value in order to acquire controlling interest in another property. This mechanism is a favorite of now discredited corporate raiders and leveraged buyout firms that currently go under the euphemism private equity firms. This claimed private equity could be a fictitious multiplication of self-assessed asset value used to buy a controlling interest in a productive company. Typically, the acquired company is put into debt, its real assets hollowed out and harvested, and then the acquired company is allowed to go bankrupt, thus making a killing for the raiders while destroying the ability of displaced workers to make a living. What a wonderful way to live. Okay, well, listening to the media, you'd be tempted to think that the U.S. economy is now pumping out huge numbers of good jobs. But that is simply not the case. Right now, there are 5.6 million fewer jobs than there were when the last recession began in late 2007. The federal government is trying to convince you that the unemployment rate is going down, but that's not actually true. The key is to look at the percentage of working-age Americans that actually have jobs. During the last recession, that percentage fell dramatically. After every other recession since World War II, the employment-to-population ratio has always bounced back. But that has not happened this time. Instead, the employment-to-population ratio has remained between 58 and 59% since the end of 2009. There has not been a jobs recovery. The average duration of unemployment continues to hover near a record high. And by the way, what's with all the wild brawls breaking out at Chuck E. Cheese restaurants all over the United States? In Susquehanna, Pennsylvania, police were called out to one particular Chuck E. Cheese restaurant 17 times in just one recent 18-month time period. Susquehanna Police Chief Robert Martin told ABC News the following about why there have been so many of these brawls in his neck of the woods, and I quote, "It got crowded. and kids would run into each other or fight over games, which would lead to parents getting involved in fights. Quote. Well, these days, many Americans seem to be so on edge that just about anything can cause them to snap. If you go onto YouTube and do a search for Chuck E. Cheese fight, it will bring up dozens and dozens of search results. And I guess, of course, the same could be said for about Denny's, IHOP, and McDonald's, too. The Chuck E. Cheese brawls are particularly disturbing because Chuck E. Cheese is supposed to be a place for children. It's supposed to be a place where they can feel safe and forget about the worries of the world for a little while. Unfortunately, Chuck E. Cheese is now a place where it seems like violence could break out at any time. Don't ignore what's going on at Chuck E. Cheese restaurants right now. The fights and brawls at Chuck E. Cheese are symptoms of what is happening to America on a larger scale. I'm afraid to say the country is changing, and it is simply not emotionally prepared for what is about to happen. So there we go. I think it's time for our break. Let's take it, and I'll be right back. Okay, so we're back, and I think we should start with an email from none other than our very own Steve Kruger, who has this to say about the recent bank stress test. Richard, is the stress test an actual audit, or is it mostly BS, with no questions harder than, how about those Yankees? You can bet that Diamond will not even think of biting the hand that feeds him. Both Diamond and the Fed exist to serve the interests of the world bankers. Richard, I don't think J.P. Morgan, the man, or the bank would exist if it were not for the European bankers. Steve Kruger. And then another one, another email that came through thick and fast on the tails of this one. And then, Richard, Citi failed the test, but wouldn't come out and say they failed. Instead, they said they just didn't pass. This reasoning is right out of 1984. Also, how in hell could they fail when they get to count liabilities as assets? Also, again, did not Citi do a reverse split at 10 to 1? That makes Citi a $3 stock. I have to think Citi's future could be measured with an egg timer. Thanks for the wake-up call, Richard, and do enjoy your extra hour every day. Yes, I think Steve is referring to the fact that last week I was rejoicing because I do get an extra hour in bed, despite the fact that you get an hour less in bed because your clocks move forward in the spring, and which effectively means that because our clocks don't do anything, in effect they go back an hour. If that makes any sense to you, that's great. It makes good sense to me because it means I get an extra hour in bed. And the wake-up call comes to you at 10 p.m. instead of 11 p.m. I appreciate that. Thank you very much, me. Well, thank you, United States, too. Can't leave them out, can we? Here's an email from Dana Cooper, who says, Dear Richard, love your show. I have a tiny apartment in New York City and use it for business. I am based in Bermuda and go back and forth for business. I don't want to give it up because hotel costs are so expensive. Do you think your advice to sell everything includes even something like this, if it is an advantage for business? Probably not, Dana. I mean, I don't know. You don't say how often you come, how many days a week you spend in the apartment. You don't tell us how much you pay on the apartment. You don't tell us how much you would otherwise spend on hotels. We can't work out the math on this one, Dana, so don't have enough information to go on. And of course, you don't say whether the business is your business or whether it's somebody else's business who pays your expenses. Lots and lots and lots of questions unanswered there, Dana. It's not really my place to help you run a business. I do think that where real estate is simply used for the purpose of living, I think that Manhattan real estate will start to take an immense downward leap once the Wall Street bubble bursts, which I think it is about to do. So those of you holding real estate in the New York area, please be prepared for a very sickening downdraft dead ahead, because I think that's what you're going to get. So, Dana, there we go. Sorry, I can't be more helpful, but anyway, if you want me to work out some math on this, then please feel free to let me have some more information. An email from Chidneys Godding. Richard, do you remember people go back to... do you recommend people go back to school? My husband is disabled. I'm between 45 and 53 and already have a BA in education. Last year, I received a grant to take a herbalism course, which I have since completed. I'm applying for another grant to continue with this training, since my goal is to become a clinical herbalist. The reason I was able to get a grant is because Vermont has a limited fund grant program that is on a first-come, first-served basis. They won't give you one if you already have a BA, but you can apply for a non-degree grant for other programs where you will not get a degree. However, I feel as though I'd need more credentials, something to fall back on. 2 months ago, I went to the post-baccalaureate program in order to get a license to teach in an elementary school, or at least tutor. I absolutely abhor the fact that I'd had loans pushed on me, that not more effort was made to steer me away from this type of education financing, especially since I know that education is free overseas, like, say, Cuba. Unfortunately, I don't have the funds to go overseas, although I do think about doing this from time to time. I'm wondering if I should opt out of this college program. I work very part-time as a caregiver for an elderly person with dementia. A penny for you, I really need and want to earn enough money where I will be more in a position to help others, as well as not having to agonize over how to spend my income. I have a strong desire to follow my callings, being a herbal clinician, being one of these, and I want to be my own boss, that is, be an entrepreneur, but should I also consider fields like nursing, dental hygiene, etc., to further bolster credentials? The idea of incurring more debt just doesn't sit well with me. I have enough debt from the college go-around. What do you think? If you need more information, let me know. P.S. I am so thankful you and your show exist. Thank you for giving your time. Chinese. Chinese, for once, I don't think I do need more information, because you seem to be a person right on the cusp of falling back into the trap of going after this education rigmarole without really having the focus on where you really can put it to good use. In other words, what I think I'm trying to say here is that the chances of your finding a job absolutely as a result of any educational course you might take at this point, Chinese, are very, very minimal indeed. I think you have all the education you can reasonably use. I think if the job market was less tight, it might be perhaps interesting to focus on some kind of a specialty and then take some courses. But in this day and age, people with advanced degrees are working in restaurants as waiters and waitresses, Chinese. I gave you some statistics about that last Friday, which you may or may not have heard. The market simply isn't there for you. I would say, whatever you do, don't take any more education. Try to put the education you have to use. I really feel that you would be better off doing that rather than spending more money and chasing a dream, frankly, which I think may not be there for you. So that would be my opinion. Of course, if you wish to do things differently, I wish you all the best of luck. I wish you all the best of luck anyway, as a matter of fact. So there you have it, Chinese. Best of luck to you. All right. Well, a new book came out the other day, which takes an interesting and unusual look at the future of power on the planet. It's called No One's World by Charles Kupchan. That's K-U-P for Peter, C-H-A-N, Kupchan. And his contention is that the world is on the cusp of a global turn. Between 1500 and 1800, the West sprinted ahead of other centers of power in Asia and the Middle East. Europe and the United States have dominated the world ever since. But today, the West's preeminence is slipping away as China, India, Brazil, and other emerging powers rise. Although most strategists recognize that the dominance of the West is on the wane, they are confident that its founding ideas, democracy, capitalism, and secular nationalism, will continue to spread, ensuring that the Western order will outlast its primacy. Kupchan boldly challenges this view, arguing that the world is headed for political and ideological diversity. Emerging powers will neither defer to the West's lead nor converge towards the Western way. The ascent of the West was the product of social and economic conditions unique to Europe and the United States. As other regions now rise, they are following their own paths to modernity and embracing their own conceptions of domestic and international order. Kupchan contends that the Western order will not be displaced by a new great power or dominant political model. The 21st century will not belong to America, China, Asia, or anyone else. It will be no one's world. For the first time in history, the world will be interdependent, but without a center of gravity or global guardian. More than simply diagnosing what lies ahead, Kupchan provides a detailed strategy for a striking bargain between the West and the rising rest by fashioning a new consensus on issues of legitimacy, sovereignty, and governance. Thoughtful, provocative, sweeping in scope, this work is nothing less than a global guidebook for the 21st century. Again, the book is called No One's World, and it is by Charles Kupchan. And there you are. Enjoy the book, and do call back in and let us know what you thought. Right, well, Zeus Yemoyanis came up with the following comment, which I thought put a lot of our troubles into perspective. He said as follows: the central question, obscured by all the hand-wringing and crocodile tears, is simply this. Why should public citizens who have no stake in private enterprises, who received no profits or dividends, who had nothing to do with creating losses, be forced to pay for private losses? The only legitimate answer is they shouldn't, period. Anything that does not acknowledge this tenet is not functioning capitalism. And if it is functioning capitalism, it cannot violate this tenet. Yet we witness apologist expert after expert excusing this fatal breach in capital practice as, quote, regrettable but necessary to save the system, unquote. They seem not to have noticed that the system has already killed itself by violating its own foundational laws and principles. If anything, current conventional practice might be accurately described as an all-out anti-capitalist assault on democratic free enterprise. So now the follow-up question is easy to answer. Why are we paying for something we did not buy and had no hand in creating? The answer? We no longer have functioning capitalism. Call it what you want. Corporate socialism, crony capitalism, cancer capitalism, plutocracy, kleptocracy, oligarchy, neo-feudalism. The system we have now is the equivalent of an individual going up to a complete stranger on the street and shaking that stranger down for protection money to pay for the individual's underwater housing mortgage. as this simple fact grips the population and people wake up to the present economic reality, there will be increasingly organized moves towards civil disobedience and alternative economy. Cannot pay will merge with will not pay. Since the only way to re-establish health and integrity in a corrupted economic system is to starve the cancers that have taken it over. This has already started with Occupy Wall Street, strategic defaults, and riots in Greece. And ladies and gentlemen, this is something which I find very interesting, because I do not think that ordinary complaining, the idea that just grating in a crowd, I do not think that that will change anything. That is a recent view of mine that I was fearful of holding in times past. But when I see the way in which the forces of law and order are basically gearing up to combat any kind of dissent, even peaceful dissent, I simply shake my head and say to myself, this is a hopeless case. I do not think that people will prevail peaceably. And I'm not one to recommend violence. It's not my style, so I'm not going to do it. But I am going to recommend yet again that your only hope of salvation will be to remove yourselves from the scene of the problem. And I say this with increased frequency, increased conviction, every single time I come on the air and talk to you, ladies and gentlemen. If I ever felt that my advice was misplaced or was not to be taken seriously, please believe me, I would tell you right away. But I don't. I feel the opposite. I feel that the more time goes by, the more the forces of law and order are girding themselves up to combat a restive population, I feel that the whole concept of public outcry is a waste of time. And if anything, there will be immense numbers of people wounded and blooded in the streets, and I don't think I want my listeners to be among those people. And so, ladies and gentlemen, you know what you have to do. Well, last Friday was the 99th anniversary of the signing of the 16th Amendment to the Constitution. It enshrined into law an idea that stands in total contradiction to the driving force behind the American Revolution and the whole idea of freedom itself. The great old right commentator Frank Chodorov once described the income tax as the root of all evil. His target was not the tax itself, but the principle behind it. Since its implementation in 1913, he wrote, and I quote, "The government says to the citizen, your earnings are not exclusively your own. We have a claim on them, and our claim precedes yours. We will allow you to keep some of it, because we recognize your need, not your right. But whatever we grant you for yourself is for us to decide." End of quote. He really does have a point. That's evil. When Congress ratified the 16th Amendment on February the 3rd, 1913, there was a sense in which all private income in the U.S. was nationalized. What was not taxed from then on was a favor granted unto you and continues to be so. This is implied in the text of the amendment itself, and I quote, "The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration," end of quote. Where are the limits? There weren't any. There was some discussion about putting a limit on the tax, but it seemed unnecessary. Only 1% of income earners would end up paying about 1% to the government. Everyone else was initially untouched. Who really cares that the rich have to pay a bit more, right? They can afford it. This perspective totally misunderstands the true nature of government, which always wants more money and more power and stop at nothing to get both. The 16th Amendment was more than a modern additive to an antique document. It was a new philosophy of the fiscal life of the entire country. Today, the ruling elite no longer bother with things like amendments. But back in those days, it was different. The amendment was made necessary because of previous court decisions that stated what was once considered a bottom-line presumption of the free society. Government cannot tax personal property. What you make is your own. You get to keep the product of your labors. Tax or raise money through tariffs on goods coming in and out of the country, but your bank account is off limits. The amendment changed that idea. In the beginning, it applied to very few people. This was one reason it was passed. It was pitched as a replacement tax, not a new money raiser. After all the havoc caused by the divisive tariffs of the 19th century, this sounded like a great deal to many people, particularly Southerners and Westerners, fed up with paying such high prices for manufactured goods while seeing their trading relations with foreign consumers disrupted. People who supported it, and they were not so much the left but the right-wing populists of the time, imagined that the tax would hit the robber baron class of industrialists in the north. And that it did. Their fortunes began to dwindle, and their confidence in their ability to amass and retain intergenerational fortunes began to wane. We all know the stories of how the grandchildren of Gilded Age tycoons squandered their family heritage in the 1920s and failed to carry on the tradition. Well, it's hardly surprising. The government put a timetable and limit on accumulation. Private families and individuals would no longer be permitted to exist except in subjugation to the taxing state. The kids left their private estates to live in the cities, put off marriage, stop bothering with all that hearth and home stuff. Time horizons shortened and the Jazz Age began. Class warfare was part of the deal from the beginning. The income tax turned the social fabric of the country into a giant lifetime boat with everyone arguing about who had to be thrown overboard so that others might live. The demon in the beginning was the rich. That remained true until the 1930s when FDR changed the deal. Suddenly the income tax would be collected, but taxed in a different way. It would be taken from everyone, but a portion would be given back late in life as a permanent income stream. Thus was the payroll tax born. This tax today is far more significant than the income tax. The class warfare unleashed 99 years ago continues today. One side wants to tax the rich. The other side finds it appalling that the percentage of people who paid no income tax has risen from 30 to nearly 50% in this period of economic downturn. Now we see the appalling spectacle of Republicans regarding this as disgrace that must change. They have joined the political classes that seek advancement by hurting people. It's extremely strange that the payroll tax is rarely considered in this debate. The poor, the middle class, and the rich are all being hammered by payroll taxes, fund failed programs that provide no security and few benefits at all. It's impossible to take seriously the claims that the income tax doesn't harm wealth creation. When Congress wants to discourage something, smoking, imports, selling stocks or whatever, they know what to do. Tax it. Tax income, and on the margin you discourage people from earning it. Tax debates are always about reform, which always means a slight shift in who pays what, with an eye to raising ever more money for the government. A far better solution would be to forget the whole thing and return to the original idea of a free society. You get to keep what you earn or inherit. That means nothing short of abolishing the great mistake of 1913. Forget the flat tax. The only just solution is no tax on incomes ever. But let's say that one day we actually become safe from the income tax collectors and something like blessed peace arrives. There is still another problem that emerged in 1913. Congress created the dreaded Federal Reserve, which effectively developed the power to create on its own all the money that government would ever need without even taxing. For the practical running of the affairs of the state, the Fed is far worse than the income tax. It creates the more insidious tax of inflation. In a strange way, it's made all the debates about taxation superfluous. Denying the government revenue does nothing but curb its appetites for liberties and property. The Fed has managed to make it impossible to starve the beast. Chodorov was correct about the evil of the income tax. Its passage signaled the beginning of a century of despotism. Property is no longer safe. Your income is not your own. You are legally obligated to turn over whatever your masters say you owe them. You can fudge this point. None of this is compatible with the old liberal idea of freedom. You doubt it? Listen to Thomas Jefferson from his inaugural address of 1801. What he said then remains true today. What more is necessary to make us a happy and a prosperous people? Still one more thing, fellow citizens. A wise and frugal government, which shall restrain men from injuring one another, shall leave them otherwise free to regulate their own pursuits of industry and improvement, and shall not take from the mouth of labor the bread it has earned. Well, there you go, ladies and gentlemen. I remind you that throughout the 19th century, the great period of great progress in the United States, not one penny of income tax was levied. So you decide what you will about income tax, but ain't necessary. All right. Well, have a wonderful week. I will be back with you on Friday. And until then, take care of yourselves. See you soon. Richard Martin saying bye-bye till then.